Yesterday, Professor Ben Ondulu, certainly one of the continent's foremost economists and economic thinkers, and until recently the governor of the Central Bank of Tanzania, popped in for a visit here at Powerhouse, and he spoke to us about his early days as an academic at the University of Dar es Salaam, his work at the World Bank as a lead economist in the region, and also setting up the African Economic Research Consortium. And of course, he's now part of the Pathways Commission, and he also had an opportunity to talk to us about some of that work that he's undertaking there. And we initially, of course, started our conversation with unpacking the history of that great nation of Tanzania, and of course the assistance that they've lended to our struggle here in South Africa, and of course the personage of one Julius Mwalimu Nyerere, and the impact that he has had on the development of that country. Take a listen to this.
I began really as an academic, straight from school, went through my bachelor's, master's, PhD, all in a go, and then began teaching and doing research. I've always been involved in conversations and dialogue on policy reforms.
Mm.
Fortunately, the time that the early 80s that I was involved at the university was also the time that Tanzania was thinking about a possible change to adopting market-oriented reforms. Nyerere was still around. The conversation is actually understood to have been, if you want, the really the anchor and the pivot for the reform process that subsequently took place. I would only say one thing, which I'm quite proud of, the fact that that conversation did front-load all the difficult questions.
Sure.
Implementation only started once those questions were resolved.
Let's step back slightly here, Prof, and maybe take a look at what happens prior to that transition. And of course, post-independence, Tanzania, and some of the policy approaches there. You would certainly have had line of sight over that as someone who was deeply embedded in the academy, analyzing, thinking quite deeply about some of these issues, and of course, the role of Tanzania in relation to the region of East Africa, and of course, in relation to the continent as well, under the rule or governance of the Mwalimu administration. Just talk to us about those days of Ujamaa, and of course, the more sort of a central command and socialist approach that was being driven at the time.
Mwalimu's probably main role in our nation is really developing Tanzania into a nation by unifying different potential ethnic groups, common language of Swahili, and instituted an education system that typically took young people into other parts of the country so that they became more of the citizen rather than the ethnic group they are coming from. And in that respect, I think he also created what we call as the DNA of the Tanzania nation, which is self-respect and always caring about not only others, but those that are poor. And the whole process and the socialist experiment was built on those particular beliefs. And even today, as we have gone through this market reforms, etc., those elements of the DNA are still strongly embedded in the way Tanzanians think about development, in the way they engage about dialogue in development, including the current regime. So this is one. When you extend that to a regional context, also Tanzania was ready on principle basis to host other nations that had independence struggle and struggles for democracy.
And a lot of our own people here, I mean, in the ANC and the PAC.
Oh, yes. A good number of them. Sometimes I get surprised. I come to South Africa and I'm speaking to a colleague in Swahili and somebody joins in fluent Swahili, only to know that it's one of those that
came from exile.
That's right. and spend time there. So I think Tanzanians never complained the fact that they had to make sacrifices to support that particular cause. So that's also Mwalimu, and it has stayed on. And over time, you know, looking at different, if you want, regimes that followed, that country has gone through a learning curve so that one regime builds on the other. Where there were mistakes, those are corrected, and the next one comes. And this learning process is very evident. If you want, Mwalimu set up the nation. Then Mwinyi actually began the reform towards market orientation, made it so free that rules were a little bit difficult to discern. Then came Mkapa, who actually put rules to that liberalization process. And Kikwete builds on that to do infrastructure and macro and growth. And the current one continues on that journey. So we just did a book that traces this particular set of decades of leadership changes.
You know, I recall towards the end of 2015, I had the fortune of being in Tanzania during the elections. And I must say, one of the striking features for me was how vibrant that process of electioneering, campaigning was. Even in the most rural of places that we visited, you would see households with their own different flags in the same community of different political organizations. And many people have always marveled why Tanzania as a nation has had such a stable post-independence period in relation, of course, to many other nations that it sits alongside, in be it in the Horn of Africa or even in other places on our continent. Do you think that that can be attributed, of course, to the DNA that you were referring to and some of the influence of Mwalimu Nyerere?
Absolutely. I think that played the pivotal role in, if you want, sustaining the kind of peaceful, but also very open engagement
and robust
and typical Tanzanian is not exactly afraid to engage in terms of self-respect. It's also true that probably most Tanzanians that went abroad always came back for the same reason. They came back to a peaceful sort of situation in the country.
Now, you also had an opportunity, I mean, during this transition towards more sort of market-driven reforms, and even during the tenure of Honorable Benjamin Mkapa, to be working as the lead economist for the World Bank in that area. And certainly, 2 decades after that, or even a few decades after that, the bank has come under immense criticism for some of the structural adjustment programs and the impact that that has had on the public sector in many African countries and its ability to deliver on much needed social and public goods. What would your response be about whether or not that process of transitioning from more central and command based economies towards more market reforms, how that unfolded, and if there were any things you would have changed, what would those have been?
Well, you know, a lot of these changes are also embedded in global, if you want, major changes in the ideas and the way things work. You will recall 60s, early 80s, most people were concerned with market failures and what governments can do to fix them, and had a big role government is playing. Came the early 80s, there's a huge switch into much more concern with government failure, just thinking that government has gone in too much to the extent that is counterproductive. But I think where we have settled is actually in the middle, where governments and markets have got to work together in order to make sure that all growth processes and development issues are actually being tackled. And that's where the pendulum is. So it went from one extreme of only market failure concerns to another extreme, which is government failure, to the middle, where it still is there now.
What do you think we are now, post-2008?
I think, largely speaking, government has an important role to deal with issues where markets certainly have not been able to deal with efficiently and effectively. And governments now have more or less embraced the fact that, you know, inflation is bad, you want macro stability. We don't have those conversations we used to have in the past anymore.
Mm.
So the goodness of some of the key macro sort of stability environment have been embraced, but at the same time, markets have come also to agree that there are failures that need to be fixed, and government has a role to play in that. And the other thing, though, is increasingly, you know, inequality is becoming a major issue, and I have no, I will not be surprised if inclusion, which has started picking up now, becomes one of the central solutions that everybody has to pursue.
When we think about that inclusion, I'd be interested to find out, I mean, what role you think there is for these three different stakeholders, one the state within the continent, the other one being the private sector, and then of course this growing, what I would call a cadre of philanthropists, or what some people have sort of termed as philanthrocapitalism, and the role of really sort of philanthropic driven kind of initiatives in being able to lend a hand and complement some of the efforts of the state and even the private sector.
Yeah, my own thinking is that philanthropy and, if you want, social impact investors as a movement, which is rising now, is partly, I think, a reflection or a response of conscience on the inequality arising from concentration of wealth. It's amazing how quickly the share of profits have risen in the distribution of you know, income and value added, and how labor is actually struggling in relation to you know, exactly, partly substitution of labor through technology and related, and technology companies have become the wealthiest. And I'm not surprised that a good bit of this philanthropy-related and supportive intervention to inclusion actually comes also from that particular slice of investors and businesses.
And for the state?
I think for the state, the major challenge in terms of inclusion is opening up. Making sure that citizen engagement is much more effective. You know, happily, I think technology is helping us with a more effective reach to citizens and engagement. It's also true that transparency and accountability are becoming also much more into the play. But inclusion, ultimately, the bottom line is caring about the poor. And whether you fix this through cash transfers or subsidies, or you enhance opportunities for the poor to earn their own better incomes, this is more or less the focus that one sees from government policy side now.
I'm also interested, and I wanted to come back to this a notion of philanthropy, and you make a very interesting point that sort of much of the philanthropy comes from the sectors that have certainly been the biggest beneficiary in the last two decades of how the global economy has shifted. And those, by and large, would be some of the tech firms. And of course, you are linked and part of an initiative here called the Pathways for Prosperity Commission. You serve there as the academic director. Just talk to us briefly about this commission. I did mention earlier on, of course, some of the people who are involved there, also including Sri Mulyani Indrawati, who's the Minister of Finance in Indonesia, alongside, of course, Melinda Gates and Strive Masiwa, who I'd mentioned earlier on. give us a sense there. I mean, we do know that in the early stages, this was something that was burst out of the Blavatnik School of Government at Oxford. And one is interested in sort of how it finds expression across the globe.
I think one of the most important objective of the commission has been to change the global conversation from looking at technology and its impact more from job losses, using labor-saving innovation, and having a doomsday prediction more or less that those who didn't make it to date have no way of making it just because technology changes are not in favor, in their favor on this. We have done work as a commission, which clearly shows that, and using the evidence, that actually innovation tends to create more jobs than the jobs it destroys. Mm. So on a net basis, this has been the case in history, it's a case now, and it's not any different. And we have looked at a number of countries where definitely innovation is taking place side by side with increased job creation on net basis. But it might not necessarily happen in the same sectors that are losing these jobs. Mm. So manufacturing, for example, has typically now moved from simply being mainly low-skill labor type or to much more technology-oriented. But, you know, it still creates big value and it interacts with the other sectors in the economy where jobs are created. So service sectors now are probably leading way in terms of creating new opportunities and jobs. And it's really a question of what quality of jobs and how the poor can actually have access to those jobs. Mm. Yeah.
And of course, some of these initiatives involve trying to really future-proof the skills profile of young people and young professionals across the entire globe, and of course, the least of all here on the African continent. And in that regard, over the next day or so, there will be a tech policy hackathon. And the moment I hear sort of policy and a hackathon in the same sentence, I must say I do get slightly startled.
Yeah. Yeah, and rightly so. Hackathon is more understood from the tech programming side.
Sure, sure.
These people sort of sitting and... But there are problems of policy that can also be solved using that kind of an approach.
Mm.
And we have assembled mostly young civil servants who are stars in their own sense, where they're working, and we're using this opportunity for them actually to look at three problems and be able to come up with solutions within the time frame of the of this particular event, and link that particularly to their own backgrounds, which is how would technology, in this case, also come to bear in getting those solutions. So it may be programming more in terms of policy
sure.
work and strategies. So we borrowed the term,
mm.
Not necessarily to mean exactly what it was, okay. which is more on the programming side.
Okay.
Yeah.
And of course, when you take a scan of some of the key tech policy issues across the globe and even here on the continent, I'm often interested in, you know, where we think some of the big debates are, because here in South Africa, we tend to sort of largely focus on the issues of transitioning from analog to digital, all the spectrum debates. But if you think globally, there's all manner of debates around what impact that technology is going to have on the future of work, cybersecurity, the use of information, and of course, data sovereignty, and all manner of other debates. What would you say are the top three issues that would certainly preoccupy many of the hackers who are going to be joining this particular hackathon.
We have selected three issues. One has to deal with solving health problems and really seeing how they can bring their skills to a particular problem of health sector in Lesotho. The second one is how to operate a system of legal aid. It's based on a case from Namibia. And the other one is based virtually in Johannesburg on urban substance abuse.
So it's more on the applied side of things.
Yeah? Yes. Yes. So each one of those are applied. Yeah. But on a broader scale, since you talked about technology on a broader scale and some of the issues they help to resolve, from the commission's end, we have looked in particular because we are concerned with inclusion at both agriculture and the informal sector. How do you make those sectors more dynamic?
Sure.
How do you add value to those sectors? How do you connect them better to the formal sector using smart technology? So smart agriculture comes to feature on these platforms that connects motorbike riders with their customers in a more efficient way. You know, all those are part of the ways in which we solve those problems at this stage. And I think the other one is just how we can use technology to make our countries much more competitive so that we can fit better into the global value chains. We always look at the border issues, but very often behind the border is where the main costs really one needs to deal with. So getting logistics, getting better connectivity within countries, all for example, would also be a way of resolving some key development issues in our countries.
Last one on my end, and I can't let you go without getting a brief history lesson at the end. On this day, 5 years ago, I think it was 5 years ago, one of the, certainly the sort of giants of the African liberation struggles and the giants of Africa, alongside the likes of Mwalimu, Nelson Mandela passed on. And earlier off air, we were talking about your involvement in an advisory capacity in some of the early policy debates that, of course, led to the Reconstruction and Development Program, of which Nelson Mandela was a major champion. Just talk to us about those early days and give us some sort of insight into the tenor that those debates in the early 90s during our transition took.
I think one of the main issues were what stance to take. Would the country go back and find who, you know, hurt them and go back to vengeance? Or is the country going to take a middle road in terms of this? I think the position of Madiba in terms of thought as a person of compromise, to a very large extent, influenced the work of the macroeconomic research group in terms of trying to find a middle road, manage expectations, but at the same time definitely pay attention to the most important sets of problems, i.e. one, correcting the imbalances in terms of fundamentals, education, and because that's where capabilities and opportunities are created. And the issue of jobs.
Which remains an issue. Yeah.
Yes, complex as it is. And not only it remains an issue here, it's becoming a bigger issue elsewhere. And particularly with the youth. Most of our populations are very young. The youth constitute more than 50%. Percent of the total population. We are not growing jobs fast enough. And for that matter, I think the focus in the early days on growth was right, partly because that's where you create job opportunities. And the focus also in making sure that business and investors continue to be an important part of the economy. So that was part of the conversation. I must say I was most privileged during that time also to be able to work close enough to this great leader for Africa. I think that still stays in me. And I must say that short stint here of 3-4 years has remained very influential in all my perspectives in my work and since then.
Governor, thank you so much for popping by and visiting us here at Power 98.7. Really appreciate that you could join us. Wish you all the best in the hackathon that's going to be happening on Thursday, 6 December. And thank you so much, really, for taking time out to speak to us and, of course, sharing your journey with us as our power suit here on Power Business. Safe to say, asante sana and safari salama.
Thank you for hosting me. Asante sana.